Welcome to the New Books Network.
What makes life meaningful? Some would say faith. Others might suggest family. Some would say good deeds or kindness, judgment, and justice. Still others recommend passion. One thing they would probably all agree on is the vital importance of meaningfulness in human life. The human condition being what it is and what it always has been, philosophers and thinkers from earliest times have grappled with the meaning of life. Today's guest has written a broad and penetrating analysis of the biblical book of Ecclesiastes' view of life's meaning, compared with other ancient worldviews, including those of Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Greek cultures. His research and insights have a great deal to offer to us 21st century readers. Welcome to the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host, and I'm delighted to welcome Arthur Jan Kiefer to the program today to talk about his exceptional book, Ecclesiastes and the Meaning of Life in the Ancient World. Arthur Kiefer teaches theology, philosophy, and religion at Eton College in England. Arthur Jan Kiefer, welcome to the podcast.
Renee, thanks so much for having me on. It's a delight to be here.
I always like to start out by asking my guests something about their early life. With you, I guess I have two areas of interest. The first is, was there a religious or spiritual background to your own childhood, your own family?
There was, and my parents and family more broadly were Protestant Christians and still are. And so church was a reality of weekly life, and we had a community of Christian friends, and in the home that was a big part of life. It looked different at different kind of ages and stages. But faith, and particularly the Christian faith, was a major part of growing up.
And what would you say were major influences on your own intellectual development as you were growing up and growing through school?
Well, I wasn't particularly an all-star student when I was younger. I wasn't kind of always getting, you know, top marks on the test, and I did my homework and got along fine and things like that. But I was always a bit interested and distracted with other things. And so music was a huge part of life growing up. And I think that was incredibly formative intellectually, actually, in terms of learning how to read music and play music and so on. And I just had other kind of crafty habits and hobbies, so building different things and getting into stuff like that. And so school was always there, and my intellectual life though was probably most formed outside of that. And a strange thing was, though, kind of in classic academic subjects, I loved math and things like that, and I really struggled to write. And so I had to learn and work a lot at writing. But now I'm writing books and never really doing math, which is kind of funny. But so I think it was kind of broader sets of hobbies and interests that were really intellectually formative. My parents were all-star students, and they were really had always been great at school and the things that they did in that regard. And so they were very and always have been supportive of education and my education. So even if I kind of warmed to academic life later on, they were fully behind that. And so I really credit them with a lot of my interests now.
That's really very interesting that math and music brought you eventually to text, which is not immediately apparent. But also that story is like many children growing up who eventually say school didn't get in the way of their intellectual development. That's the most they could say about grade school, elementary school, and high school. Your path brought you to some really important insights, which we'll try to share with the listeners now, and we'll turn to your book. Start by explaining the lens through which you examine the meaning of life, psychology's threefold concept.
If you asked anyone on the street what they thought the meaning of life was, I think you'll get some different answers. And I suspect that they will eventually kind of materialize and gather into a few similar answers. So they'd eventually kind of connect and you'd find some patterns. I draw particularly on people who have studied, not consulting people on the street, but doing empirical work and talking to people about what they think the meaning of life is. And in 2016, there was a really wide-ranging article that took a lot of the studies from the social sciences on the meaning of life and really kind of cohered it all and summarized things and drew out some of the patterns that they found in those studies. And they came up with a threefold understanding of the meaning of life. And the first category is coherence, second is significance, and the third is purpose. And so these are the categories that I use across the book, and I can explain those and draw those out, of course. But the so it's really drawing from that, the social sciences. There's both kind of theory-based studies of the meaning of life, and then really a lot of dealing with people on the ground and figuring out what they mean and what it might mean to not have meaning in life, and which of the types of meaning is more important. And that sort of thing. So I really do, in a not totally artificial, but certainly in an external sense, take those categories and then use them as the lens through which I read the book of Ecclesiastes.
It's a very comprehensive approach to it, and it enables the reader, both the reader of your book and the reader of that research, to get a grip on a concept that can be a little ambiguous at times. So purpose and significance are two almost, well, why don't you define them as the research defines it?
Sure. Purpose is really anything that lends direction to life. And now when we're talking about these meaning of life categories, this is really all revolves around an individual. So I guess you could extend it to communities, but it's really talking about an individual from their perspective, what gives life meaning or how they understand meaning. So some people would say technically that's meaning in life. Do you have meaning in your life? As opposed to another huge question of the meaning of life. So what is or should be the kind of meaning of everyone's life as being a human? So purpose is really anything that lends direction to life. It can be framed in terms of goals, a mission, and really, to use its own word, just a purpose. And so that's often, you know, given to people, or we give it to ourselves and that sort of thing. Significance is really something inherent about life. Is life valuable? Is it worthwhile? And really the kind of kicker question here is life worth living? Then you might say, why is it worth living? And that would fill out what makes life significant.
But it's coherence that interests Ecclesiastes. So let's see why that is so important to him. Why is that what troubles him?
Yeah, coherence, I think it's a little bit more, it's a little less intuitive, I think, these days than the other two. But coherence is referring to patterns that reliably link up in the world. It's more external than purpose, more external than significance, in the sense that it depends a bit more on just you and what you think and what you do. So coherence would be the kind of reliability of how things work out in life. So you might think about it in terms of input and output. If I do one thing, does the kind of right thing result? And related to that, it also is tied to sense making. So does my life make sense? Do the things that I do really add up in the scheme of things? So someone might think about this commonly in terms of career progression, right? So if I work this many hours a week and treat my colleagues in this way and I have these credentials, then surely there's some expected sense of outcome for that in terms of where someone's career might go and so on. And then when it doesn't, when those things don't give the outputs that people think they will or expect them to, or kind of look around the rest of the world and see happening, then that's when life becomes incoherent and it doesn't make sense and it becomes meaningless. And it's those sorts of connections that Ecclesiastes is primarily concerned about. So things like if a father amasses wealth and works really hard, and he does so through wisdom and prudence, and then his son inherits that wealth, but his son is not wise and basically squanders all the wealth. That's an example of things not really going as they should and certainly not going as planned. And the author of Ecclesiastes seems a little bit, certainly troubled, a bit confused, and kind of throws his hands up about these sorts of things that he observes in life.
He at times goes well beyond confused to seeming bitter and cynical as he looks around the world and everything in it. He repeats a phrase, a very famous, well-known phrase. In Hebrew, it's Hevel Havalim, which is often translated as vanity of vanities in English. But what do you think Ecclesiastes actually means when he uses that Hebrew word, Hevel?
The book uses several key terms, and that one is probably the most prominent and certainly the most well-known. The word itself, Hevel, refers to breath. It can refer to a kind of vapor, and in a very concrete sense. So you get other passages where someone's breath or vapor was somewhere, passed through, or whatever it is. It's used to refer to the kind of worthlessness of things, or their being vain in the kind of futile sense. And so that's where we get the vanity translation. So the idols of other nations are Hevels, really, as the prophets refer to it. I prefer not to translate the word, and I think it kind of has a, because it has a bit of a range of meaning, it's not entirely clear what it's meant to refer to or how it might be best for us translated. And so I kind of leave it be, and I like its kind of richness and some of its ambiguity. But I think we can in most cases it refers to some sense of being kind of futile in the sense of something doesn't add up and even just incoherent. So it's pretty clear that it, from the meaning of life perspective, it can refer to things that simply are incoherent. But it's used in other places in the book to mean some slightly different things. So it's hard to pin down one meaning of the word throughout the whole book that's consistent throughout the whole book. And that really troubles some people, and they want to find something that fits, or they want to find two options that fit. But I don't think that's a problem at all, really. And we kind of just let it be and take it case by case.
And you follow the thread in the book that the issue that is most deeply disturbing to Ecclesiastes is the unpredictability, the unreliability, and therefore the meaninglessness of life as Hevel, that actions don't always have the same consequences. Some children are raised with a great deal of attention and kindness, and they turn out to be serial killers. And other children are neglected, and they turn out to be pillars of the community. And this, you argue, is what causes pain, despair, and anger to the writer of Qohelet. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you get, I mean, those are excellent examples. And you get things kind of like that in here. And so, and it centers on expectations. And so what we expect from those, you know, as you say, certain children, and also from, well, there's another word used for toil in the book. And so this kind of work or kind of exertion. And part of what Kohelet is doing is examining, kind of sets up an investigation, an examination of everything, as he says, under the sun. And this is probably just referring to the kind of human realm. He's not looking up into heaven or ethereal things. He's kind of just observing his world. And part of what he sees are these different instances and occurrences. And, you know, maybe not totally comprehensive, but the book is set up in a way to kind of say, I'm looking at everything that humans do, all that they do, all their toil that they do under the sun. So there's a bit of a universalization going on. And maybe it's no surprise that Ecclesiastes is a favorite book among many people, and it's certainly a relatable book in terms of you get all kinds of people from all different backgrounds that I've spoken with, and they really can take something away or relate to Ecclesiastes.
Yes, he's talking about the universal, and that made it extremely interesting that you put him in the context of other ancient writers and thinkers in the Middle East, well, in the Mediterranean area, that dealt with the same issues, because of course they're the same issues because it's the human condition. The cultures you look at are Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Greece. So can you just tell us a little bit about how Ecclesiastes compares? Let's start with his Egyptian counterpart.
Sure. The text I select for these different cultures are, you know, they're a bit wide ranging. They're certainly wide ranging in time and a bit wide ranging in geography, though. You know, these are some texts. Many of these texts are texts commonly used in biblical studies, particularly of the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, and so they're drawn upon from time to time for more or less, I think, for different books or different areas of study. So the Egyptian texts I look at are in part they're kind of instructional literature, so they're versions of Proverbs, and I also look at some laments, and then a kind of, it's a bit hard to categorize, it's a dispute between a man and his ba, or his kind of soul sort of thing. And so it's this really long poem exploring society and this man's response to it. So again, it's an eclectic bunch of texts, but the reason I look closely at these is because they make some link between suffering and the meaning of life. And that's the pattern I found in Ecclesiastes. So while the book of Ecclesiastes as a whole deals with each of these categories of meaning of life in a distinct way, and particularly coherence seems a big one, it is, as we said before, consistently linked up with suffering in some sense, particularly of the author who is says he hates life. He was grieved in his heart. He saw this evil and was sorrowful and things like that. And so I look for any of those patterns across Egypt. And what I found was in these kind of big poetic lament texts, you also get people basically examining society, their society, in some degree, and they see a bit of a mismatch between basically what they think should be happening in terms of patterns in the world, and they see social patterns upset, they see injustice, and things like that, and that does bother them as well. In the instructional texts, so proverbial type of literature, you really get a big pattern of coherence. So in the same way that we might read Proverbs and say, oh, well, Proverbs, things add up, things are coherent. When someone tries to save their money, they they hold on to their wealth. When someone works hard, they gain wealth, and so on. Those sorts of patterns, as opposed to lose it or losing it to someone or something. So that similar kind of coherent pattern occurs in the instructional texts of Egypt, and then you get a few exceptions in there, but it's helpful to have that norm, and then you can see the other texts and how they take exception to that. Maybe the last thing I'll say about that is then you also get purpose. It comes through mainly through the presence of death and the reality of death. And so the Egyptians had a pretty distinct view of this. They were thought really to have a fairly positive view of life, if I can put it that way. But life really kind of continued on into the next realm. And that's really evident in things like the pyramids and the artifacts that have been left behind from ancient Egyptian culture. And so they had a pretty clear view of the judgment of the dead, how they were judged and what you needed to do in that moment. And then also the types of ways that kings particularly and other kind of prominent people could affect their existence in the afterlife. And so it's hard. I don't want to kind of go speaking for an everyday Egyptian in the ancient world. That's pretty difficult to do. We really get the texts that we have are really sampling the kind of cream of the milk. So it's right off the top. And it's quite hard to know about what broad sets of society would have thought about things or how they would have been living or conceived of these ideas. But we do have a pretty select sample of people and times and ideas.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One thing that struck me, and I believe you pointed out in your text, is the difference between the Egyptian and Ecclesiastes view of the point of pain and suffering. That the Egyptian, his Egyptian counterpart, if we can say it that way, seemed to think that anxiety and grief can produce good results if someone is guided or guides himself or herself through it effectively, kind of like what people talk about today as post-traumatic growth. That's how I imagine the meaning was. But Ecclesiastes sees nothing good about pain. He seems to say, take it out of your heart and soul and replace it with joy, which is a whole nother topic of how you do that. That happiness comes not through grief and suffering, but independent, despite life suffering. Is that a correct interpretation of the difference between them? Of a difference, let's...
That's exactly right. I was really interested to find that and discover that, actually. And it's true. Ecclesiastes isn't... It doesn't want to make space for those painful moments and painful experiences. And by that, I mean, in terms of what it's advocating for and saying how you should deal with that, it's not so much to embrace those. It's going to say this is a reality of life. This is the way life is. Don't embrace that to whatever extent you can. Find the joy, find the things that are happy in life, and particularly embrace whatever it is that it calls it a lot, but your kind of portion in life. So what God has given you to do and be, and the people He's given you to be around, that kind of thing. But yeah, the Egyptian view had a bit. Yeah, it was a bit more maybe redeemable or constructive view of some of that suffering and pain, and that it might produce something good in the person. And I think that, as you say, I think that there's certainly space for that, and certainly space for that in the Bible. I mean, Proverbs would be a bit more about tough love and saying, you know, you might go through some hardship, and not least the teaching of the book, and really have to work through that and come out better on the other side. But Ecclesiastes, for the kind of slightly narrow scope that it gives us on things in terms of a point of view, it's going to say that this is the way things are, but let me advise you otherwise.
Right. Well, that's why some of the traditional commentaries opine that Proverbs was a product of a midlife writer. Who still believes that nose to the grindstone, play by the rules, do everything right, and you'll win the prize, and that Ecclesiastes is written by an older person who says, well, sometimes that works, but sometimes it doesn't. But of course, there are many points of view of who wrote the texts and when and how old they were. We don't have time to go through a comparison with each one, although it's certainly well worth reading, listeners. I hope you will read the book and look at how these philosophers viewed meaning of life. But Kohelet is very different from Greek philosophers, but shouldn't they be able to be in harmony with one another? Take the Epicureans, for example. They prized tranquility and living in tune with nature, avoiding pain and fear, and especially the fear of death. Why wouldn't that be meaningful in the paradigm, the cognitive view of Ecclesiastes?
Yeah, the Epicureans, as you say, thought pain didn't really arise from nature or sort of incoherent things in life, but the primary cause of pain was unnatural human fear. And so what they saw was just something you shouldn't have, these human fears. And so they think you can kind of resolve that by kind of taking control of these fears and adjusting your view on the world. It's kind of an internal thing. The world's going to be what it is, and you're in control of what's inside of you. And so one of the big differences I see between Ecclesiastes and the Epicureans is that they think through kind of study and knowledge of maybe yourself and even the world, you're going to produce happiness, because your fears are largely irrational, for lack of a better thing. And that's as opposed to the kind of living in ignorance and then fear and then resulting in pain. But for Kohelet, the investigation into life, into all these things and the incoherence that he sees, is really that it produces more, it produces less happiness, it produces more pain. And so there's this really clear correlation between the kind of study and investigation of life and the kind of frustration that it begets.
That's so remarkable. Yeah. And the first time one encounters that, here is an investigator who's gathered the wisdom of the world as he knows it in his time and is trying to dig deep into the meaning of life. And one of his apparent conclusions is what I'm doing and what you, the reader, are doing with me is a cause of suffering.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty remarkable. It is remarkable, really. And I think it's long debated what the, as you'll know, long debated what this final passage in the book kind of means, and if it relates to the rest of what's come before it, and how it relates. And so I'm referring to this this part of the end of chapter 12, really, where the author says, you know, fear God, keep His commandments. This is the whole kind of this is the whole of humankind, the whole duty of them, really. God's going to judge every deed. And there is a level, I think, with that kind of relatively straightforward advice, if you link that with some of the other things that I mentioned about taking your lot or embracing the portion that God's given you, so whatever He's kind of put before you to do, I think that's a big part of Qohelet's solution. If he does have a solution, it's basically to say, listen, I've investigated this. It results in pain. You're probably going to feel that too as you read this book. Have you thought about these things too? And I'm sure we can point to many philosophers throughout time who have thought hard about life and ended up on the despairing end of things. And so he kind of says, don't think about it so much. Just kind of do what's before you, and especially don't start trying to do too much predicting about the future and so on. And so what's there before you to do? What can you worry about today? It recalls New Testament passages actually about it, that today has enough worry for itself, and so focus on that.
Yes, be present in what's right in front of you. Qohelet's emphasis on essentially the cognitive aspect of meaning in life, which is coherence, would he have anything to say to his colleague in the text, Job, to ease his suffering? Job's losses were personal. His suffering was physical and emotional. It had a cognitive component. Why did the good suffer? He didn't deserve it. What does Qohelet's philosophy have to say to Job?
Yeah, Job is kind of testing and maybe discovering the limits of his knowledge about how the world works, how relationships work, how being wise and righteous works. And so you can see a lot of incoherence in the book. Here's a man who we might say deserves or is rightly entitled to a decent life, given what we're told about him at the beginning, and then he gets the complete opposite of that and gets so many things taken away and endures hardship. And so much of the middle of that book and in its kind of dialogue bits is really teasing out what he thinks about being innocent and what his friends think about him undergoing pain and suffering and the kind of loss that he's had. And, you know, he comes out on the other side restored. But before he does that, he has this sort of great confrontation with God who basically says, my ways are my ways. And, is actually one verse that says, these are the outskirts of his ways. What a whisper do we hear of him and the thunder of his power? Who can understand? That this is referring to God. And I think that really captures a lot of what Job is meant to learn and what readers can take away from that book. So in a way, Ecclesiastes kind of picks up from there and says, I'm going to show kind of this widespread incoherence. It doesn't always go well for the righteous, and it doesn't always go badly for the wicked. And then kind of takes us to the next step, maybe. So I guess that's how I'd see the two books relating.
Ecclesiastes recommends joy as a response to suffering. And what he says is, it contradicts conventional wisdom in psychology today, which is he sees joy as a God-given ability to enjoy something. It's not a decision to be positive and say everything is beautiful or, you know, even if it seems bad, it's really good. He seems to think that the ability to enjoy anything is a gift from God, which the more we learn about endorphins, actually, we may agree increasingly with Kohelet. How does that work in a philosophical religious context, though?
It's a good question. It's a difficult one, actually. And you're exactly right that he's going to say basically God gives people joy, and he's even going to say some God doesn't give other people joy. I mean, it's pretty coarse. It's a bit difficult to deal with, I think. And even has a bit of one of the case studies in the book really talks about this very thing, right? He's seeing that someone had this life basically that God enabled them to enjoy and all this stuff and abundance and things like that, and then there was another person who didn't have it. But your question was how it relates to kind of contemporary religious notions of joy. I think there is a sense, I think, today that joy is really in your control, and it's really just what you make of your situation. Now, I think I wouldn't want to say too much about this until I put Ecclesiastes in its broader context in the Bible. And so I referred earlier to Ecclesiastes, on the one hand, having a universal kind of scope, so the investigation is wide-ranging. But Ecclesiastes does nonetheless give us a slightly narrow view on some of the things that it talks about. And by that, I mean, its view of God, for instance, is it's certainly not the whole picture of God that we get throughout the Bible and even in other individual books of the Bible. And so it would depend a bit on what religion people are a part of course, and things like that. But I think, you know, before I said anything about a particular religion and how the joy works there, that Ecclesiastes is, you know, it is one part. If it was the only book we had, for instance, to go on any of these topics, then I think that would obviously be a bit dramatic. But it's not the only view, and so we get these different themes, joy included, teased out throughout other parts of the Bible.
Finally, Arthur, please expand on your conclusion, the book's conclusion, that the book of Ecclesiastes, unlike, for example, some of the Psalms, doesn't say that the human condition will change, but rather, as you write, he invites the readers to adjust. What does that entail?
If the book is portraying this, well, it's portraying a human condition. It's really portraying a world condition. This is the way that the world is. This is the way that he's seen the world work. And I think, as attested throughout time, and interpreters and just everyday readers of the book, that this makes a lot of contact with how our world works and has worked in many ways and times. So there's a sense of inviting the reader in to say, this is how the world works. Here are some kind of suggestions. Here are a few certainties, despite Kohelet being so uncertain about many things, about the timing of death, even about perhaps what happens after death and so on, that there are some things that he's quite certain about. And so there is an invitation to kind of grab onto those things. But it's really giving people a perspective on the world and maybe on of the world in its kind of harsher realities. So I wouldn't want to say this is how all of life and all of experience is all the time. And I don't know that the author wants to do that either. But what I think he is doing at least is saying some of the time life is really like this. And so how are you going to deal with that, given these few suggestions and a lot of observations. So one of the ways that it seems like the book might be kind of cluing us into the fact that these are, while these might be universal and widespread things, they aren't necessarily the things that happen all the time, or perhaps maybe in a way the norm. We would say that. So if I was said, is it normal that someone who works with wisdom then leaves it over to a foolish child? That kind of thing. He uses this phrase: there is a person, or there was a man, or I saw this person in this instance. And some interpreters think that is basically flagging up. This is a kind of exception to the rule. I saw a person, and this is what happened to them. So, you know, there's a few things to kind of juggle and balance here. But I think that's what I meant by that conclusion.
Uh-huh. So do you think, as many people do, that Qohelet is a depressing book?
I like to think of Qohelet as a realistic book. I mean, it's certainly a downer. I think it is. There are difficult things to read in there, and I think if you kind of breeze through it, it's not necessarily going to be the most uplifting thing. I think when you start to tease those kind of implications out, thought through implications, for example, about, you know, relieve yourself of the anxiety, given what he said, relieve yourself of the anxieties about trying to predict every outcome and control life all the time, and let some things go. And focus just on what's before you, on your current circumstance. Now, again, this is where the balance comes in. Proverbs is going to say, you ought to make some plans, really, and don't just leave everything up to the last minute, that sort of thing. And so we get broadly a balanced view throughout a few of these books. But in a way, it can be a little bit relieving. And I suspect, thinking maybe of people who have had severe instances of incoherence in their life. And so this idea of a kind of, I don't know, an unexpected, undeserving inheritor, or working in one way and another outcome happening, and so on. That sort of thing. That this might provide not so much a depressing thought and influence on them, but in some ways a kind of bit of a reality check, and maybe even a bit of reassurance. I mean, often you'll be familiar with this, that talking with people who are going through something difficult or a problem that they're really struggling with, I mean, 90% of the time, people just want to know and to hear that someone else has the same problem, that they're not alone, and that the only person facing this struggle, and out of that, a lot of kind of healing and direction can come.
I agree. I think one of the great contributions of this book is to the reader who recognizes her own darkest thoughts and says, well, here it is as part of the Bible. It's okay that I've thought this way. I think that in itself is very reassuring and supportive. Thank you so much for opening this book of wisdom literature for us. Before I let you go, can you share with us what you're working on now?
What I'm working on now is broadly kind of Old Testament and Hebrew ethics. So ethics has always been an interest of mine, a kind of side interest or a companion interest to the Bible. And so I'm kind of working on small projects as they come across in terms of ethical questions and issues throughout the Bible, but also kind of working on something a little more comprehensive and wide ranging, and starting in Genesis, really. So I'm in Leviticus right now and really, really enjoying, goodness, Leviticus rewards a close reading. It has been fascinating, but ethics and across the Old Testament.
Well, we really do need some work in ethics in this world of ours, don't we? So I wish you a lot of strength going forward, and I look forward to reading what comes out of that work. Congratulations on this major treatment of Ecclesiastes and his friends. and thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Renee, thanks so much. This has been a real delight to be on the podcast. I really appreciate the invitation.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.